Welcome to Disciple City Church Podcast. My name is Jerry Wagner, founder and lead pastor of Disciple City Church in Dallas, Texas. Thank you for tuning in. Our desire is to unleash a family of healthy disciple makers in Dallas to reach the world. God bless you as you listen and consider subscribing so that you can listen to new messages each week. Thank you and have a God-filled day.
Inspired by the great Jackie Hill Perry, she talked about this story in 2016 where it was this young man named Christopher Ward Jr. Christopher, at birth, was blind. His condition was known as optic nerve hypotasy, meaning the optic nerves never fully developed at birth. His mother's name was Marquita Hackley, and she loved this little boy. I mean, he was vibrant. He was funny. He had a typewriter. He had a Cowboys jersey on, which that kind of threw the story off for me, but I stuck with it. But he was just this wonderful young boy at the age of 12. In fact, in the interview, as I was watching it on YouTube, and you can go and watch it as well, Ms. Hackley said, "We were under the impression that he was going to remain like this for the rest of his life." Now, being a parent of a child who has special needs, I can concur with that statement. That somewhere along the line, you reserve yourself to say, "This is just how my baby is going to be." But there's also this sense of hope, this sense of desire that there's a cure out there that can take your child from this state of specialness to normalcy. And that day came for Christopher and his mother. There was a device that has been created known as the eSight. The eSight. And simply explain it, eSight is a pair of glasses that those who are visually impaired or blind put on so that they can see the world in a very digital way. Just go on the site. I'm reading stories or whatever, but it's nice that like they look like something straight out of like Star Wars, right? And so Christopher and his mother goes into the doctor's office. They put the glasses on, and Christopher is like surveying the room, and he's looking around. Even in the video, you can see that he's doing certain tests to help to see if his vision is coming in sharp. And as he's looking around, he finally pans, and he sees his mother. And the first words that came out of his mouth was, "Mommy, there you are. You're beautiful." He said, "I can see her eyes, and I can see her hair. Mommy, you are beautiful." In the moment that our sister heard the voice of her son describe her look, she began to weep as well. Because for the first time, this boy who she had been nurturing and loving and cleaning and playing with can see his mother. As I watched this video, and I begin to examine Christopher's response and his mother's response, it dawned on me that it is one thing to see, but it's another thing to be seen. It is one thing for your vision to be able to be peered upon someone. It's another thing to be seen for the first time. Some of us who feel lonely feel like one who is unseen. Some of us who are navigating this pressure of loneliness, we feel unseen. And let me explain this. This is deeper than sight. It speaks of one's worth and one's value and one's connection to humanity. This is not just about someone seeing you with their eyes. This is about one's dignity. That not only can you see me externally, but do you know me internally? I begin to search, what is this invisibility? Like, how does the culture kind of package when a person feels unseen? And here's some terminology. Those who feel unseen oftentimes refer to themselves as socially or emotionally invisible. Those who are not either accepted in culture or not understood by culture, they refer to themselves as invisible. And here are some of the words that some of these persons who are experiencing this indivisibility have said. Listen to these things. Sometimes I wonder if anyone truly sees me or if I'm just a ghost passing through life. Another person says, I feel like I'm standing in a crowded room and yet I am utterly alone. Another person says, being invisible to the world is one thing, but feeling invisible to yourself is a whole other kind of loneliness. Being invisible is tough. Being unseen is tough. Listen to their questions. One person asks, does anyone truly care about me? Or am I just a burden to those around me? Another person says, will anyone ever understand the pain that I am going through? Or am I doomed to suffer in silence? Here's the final one. What's the point of reaching out for help when no one ceases to notice or acknowledge my struggle? Anybody feeling invisible today? Anybody can resonate with some of those things as you hear those words? They're beginning to pierce your very soul because you know what it's like to be lonely. You know what it's like to be isolated. You see, when I see Christopher's joy and his mother's joy as they share in their pain, I can't help but to notice these questions and these observations for these people who feel invisible. And it causes me to ask one simple question. How does God comfort the lonely? Like, how does God, the maker of heaven and earth, how does he comfort those who are lonely? Those who feel disconnected and unseen in a world that he created. How does he navigate that tension with his image bearers? And I think the best story to answer this question is an Egyptian by the name of Hagar. Remember her name. Hagar. If you want to examine someone who navigates loneliness and isolation in such a way that she draws near to God and not away from God, study the story of Hagar. Her story is a heavy story. It is a tragic story, and yet it has triumphance at the end of it. And so before I tell you how God responds to those who are lonely, let me give you some background, some context to the story that we are entering into. When we enter into Genesis chapter 16, there is a narrative shift. Up until now, the only thing that we have been talking about is Abraham as the one who is going into the promised land. Genesis chapter 12 all the way through 15 is dealing with the patriarch Abram or Abraham. But now we move from the promised land to now the promised seed. The author is setting his readers up that God has made this covenant with Abraham, who is going into this promised land, who is the father of many, and now he's waiting on this promised seed. And the one who is about to bring this promised seed is Sarai, oftentimes referred to as Sarah. But there's a problem. Sarah, or Sarai, can't have children. She's barren. And it almost feels like a climactic moment that never happened, because everyone is anticipating this promised seed. And the first words you read in the text is, Sarai is barren. She cannot have children. Look at verses 16, verses 1 through 22, and it reads, Abraham's wife, Sarai, had not borne any children for him, but she owned an Egyptian slave named Hagar. Sarai said to Abram, since the Lord has prevented me from bearing children, go to my slave. Perhaps through her, I can build a family. And Abram agreed to what Sarai said. There's a lot going on in this text. And one of the things that I personally want to be empathetic towards is a woman who cannot have children. Whether we're talking about the ancient Near East or we're talking about now, but women who struggle with infertility oftentimes are treated unjustly in our culture. See, oftentimes women who cannot have children are oftentimes looked at as incomplete or inadequate. Their womanhood is challenged. Their role is challenged. Oftentimes, people make assumptions about their health, make assumptions about their morality. Women who cannot have children oftentimes is treated in a way that creates shame, exclusion, and discrimination. So when I read this text and I see what is going on, that her wound is there, there's a level of empathy. But while I am empathetic to the injustice of those women who suffer through infertility, the way that Sarai went about securing her status was hurtful. The way she went about making sure that this shame and this discrimination fell upon her was hurtful. Why do I say that? Because instead of her looking at the promise giver, Yahweh, she looked at her property, the Egyptian slave, Hagar, as her solution. Instead of looking at the God who promised that she would bring forth a seed, that they would bring forth a seed, she's looking at her property, Hagar, as the solution to her status change. Now, let me be fair to Sarah. Sarah was following a custom that was acceptable in her time. It was acceptable that a person could use their slave to be impregnate to make sure that their lineage was continued. This was an acceptable reality in her culture. So what Sarah is doing at first, I don't think is a character issue. I don't think it is a rebellious issue. What I think is she is looking at culture as the standard of her solution. And let me say this, just because something is right in the culture does not make it right in the kingdom. Just because the culture says it's okay does not mean that God above says it's okay. Here's the truth. Going against God's plan will not only harm us, but it will harm others. Going against God's design, not only is it going to hurt us and oftentimes delay or detour us in ways that is counter to God's plan for us, but it's also going to hurt those who are involved. Hagar is hurt by Sarai and Abram. And she ain't just hurt, y'all. She's abused. She ain't just abused, but she's treated as subhuman in respect. Let me give you a fresh perspective on Hagar so that we don't make the mistake that oftentimes when people read this story, we think Hagar is a side chick. Those who know, they know. You know, so I'm like, what's a side chick? I explain in a second. I just gonna come back around, right? Hagar was obedient to her master. Hagar was obedient to the customs of that time. The problem is they didn't talk to Hagar about whether she wanted to have a baby with an 80-year-old man. That's something you need to talk about. 80, I don't care what it looks like. That's nasty. All right. I ain't gonna go no further than that, because you know, right? She was talked to, not talked with. Secondly, Hagar never is mentioned by name by Sarai or Abram. They never mention her by name. The only reason why we know her name in the first verse is because of what the author said, not because of what Abram and Sarah had said. Why? Because they see her as property, not a person. This is how this image bearer of God is being treated in the text. Secondly, Hagar is not a concubine. She's not a side chick. In fact, when we read verse 3, it's going to say that when Sarah gave her to Abraham as his wife, her status had changed. Her rights had changed. The moment that she consented to the customs of the time, according to her owner, she was no longer a concubine. She was a wife. And that's not always true in the culture. Because oftentimes people ask, where did Hagar come from? Well, if you go back to Genesis chapter 12, remember when Sarah and Abraham was in Egypt and Abimelech was the king? You remember what Abraham did? He said, hey, tell him that you're my sister so that I might live. God came down and was about to bring judgment on the house. Abimelech like, he said this. And as they are going away, he blesses them. Well, one of the things that happened, a part of that blessing, is a servant came along with it named Hagar. Now, at least in Hagar's mind, she is thinking, I am moving away from being a concubine to a blessed position. In her mind, she's like, man, I'm going to a better position than this. So when you think about Hagar, Hagar is obedient. Hagar is a servant. But in all of her obedience, and even in her status change, the text says she was mistreated. It is the same Hebrew word that you see in the book of Exodus when the children of Israel are being afflicted. The irony that this Egyptian is being afflicted by these Israelis. It's going to switch soon. Don't wait. It's going to switch soon, right? Look at Genesis chapter 16, verses 4 through 6. The text says, he referred to Abram, slept with Hagar, and she became pregnant. When she saw that she was pregnant, referring to Sarai, her mistress became contemptible to her. Then Sarai said to Abram, you are responsible for my suffering. I put my slave in your arms. And when I saw that she was pregnant, I became distressed. I became contemptuous towards her. May the Lord judge between me and you. Abram replied to Sarai, here, your slave is in your power. Do whatever you want with her. Sir, y'all made this plan. You all came up with this. And all of a sudden you see that she's pregnant and you upset? You mad? See, sometimes when we do things that are in contrast to God's plan, we get what we want, but we don't want what we got. That's old school right there. Sometimes you get things that you want, and then you be like, nah, I ain't really want that. Right? Look at me. Like, come on. Shame the devil, tell the truth. You wanted this. The problem is you did not want it because you wanted to continue the lineage of you and Abraham. You wanted it because you wanted your status to change. Pastor, how do you know this? Because when she says, I want to build my own family, the word build there is speaking of status. It's not speaking of lineage. In fact, Sarai never referred to Ishmael as her son. I don't know who felt that, but when you are in the house, when somebody doesn't see you as a sibling or a daughter or a son, that's painful. When you are in a house and you're not a part of the biological lineage and you see your biological siblings get things that you don't get, that's hurtful. And the reason why it resonates with somebody like me is because I personally went through that. I am the second son of eight children. The second son of eight children. And of those, I am also the second oldest. My other siblings, who I did not grow up with, they got a chance to be with my father. And I remember being mad and angry that they had the benefit of knowing his name, knowing his birthday, being protected by him. And me and my brothers had to protect ourselves. And I remember one of my siblings came up to me at the age of, I think I was like 13 or 12. And he said, "Hey, I'm your brother." Man, it ignited violence in me. And so when I read this story and I see that she's being treated as a second class citizen when she has the status of a wife, it's disturbing to me. So with the Hagar, let me give you this one. Notice he said to her, "Do with her as you will." The Hebrew word there is do what is right in your own sight. Anybody read the book of Judges? In the book of Judges, the theme in the book of Judges is do what is right in your own sight. Anytime humans do what is right in their own sight, it is terrible. Anytime humans have forethought, foresight to say, "I am going to build my kingdom, I'm going to do whatever I want to," it is chaos. Read the book of Judges. It is pure chaos. And Abram, with his passive self, "You take care of that. You do whatever you want to." Don't let Abram off the hook here, y'all. Abram is just like Adam. He said nothing. He's passive. He's not involved. He's only involved. Okay, I'm not going to go there. Let me move on. You got me, right? There's a lot of... this text, I did not want to preach this text because it's so emotional. And I think the emotion that you are seeing me exhibit is because I am the son of a single mother. And I know what it's like to be a son of a single mother and how they are treated and how they are looked at and how they are afflicted. And what happens to sons of single mother is we get angry and we become very protective. And I'm looking at the story of this woman, Hagar, who was obedient. And how she is being treated is overwhelming. I didn't write any of this down because I'm like, I didn't want to go here. So what does Hagar do in her abuse? What does this Egyptian woman do in her abuse? She did what most abusers do. They run. She did what most of us do. She isolated herself. Look at verse 6. "And Sarai mistreated her so much that she ran away from her." Some of us have been running for a very long time. Some of us have isolated ourselves from the abuse that we have experienced. And those who are on the outside can't understand the exterior isolation comes from an internal trauma. They can't understand that the reason why one is behaving this way is because there's something on the inside that has been torn up so much that it is spilling over and spilling out. All trauma victims are not invisible. Some of them are visible with invisible pain. I can always tell a boy who's not been raised by his father. I know the signs. I see the temperament. I can always tell by a young man how he moves and how he walks, how he responds to male authority. I can always tell he wasn't raised with his dad. You know why? Because that was me. That was me. And even now, as I think about it, being a father who just celebrated my daughter's graduation. And oh, by the way, can I brag just a little bit? This girl, oh my goodness, this girl, at the age of 16, entered into college, graduated with honors. Not only did she graduate with honors, but she also has an associate's degree. Now she has a full ride, almost. We got to pay $5,000. I'm just going to be honest with you. But a full ride to a college. And if she does what I know she would do, she will only be there for 2 years. That's my baby. And even then, I don't always feel like the best dad. I know what it's like to see this woman and to see what she's going through. I've heard this story. This isn't new to me. And I know for some of you all, it's not parental wounds. It's cultural wounds. It's church wounds. You have wounds all over this place. And you feel either socially or emotionally invisible, and you are hiding. Can I say something to you? God is pursuing you. God hears you, and God sees you. For whoever is hiding, whether you are hiding in these seats or hiding behind this camera, I need you to hear something in your invisibility that God is pursuing you. That he is listening to your burdens, your cry, your pain, your doubts. And he sees you. Not the makeup you. Not the one who sprays on a lot of cologne you. Not the one who says every time somebody asks you, are you good? Oh, bro, I'm great. Nah, that's not the one that God sees. God sees the one when you go home, you lonely. God sees the one when you go home, you're crying. God sees the one when you act out and behave in such a way, hoping that people don't really get close to you to know who you really are. That's the person that God sees. If I feel a little bit of charge, man, just know this was me. I wish I could have preached it from Ishmael's standpoint, and I will one day. I'm going to stay with Hagar today, but one day I'm going to preach from Ishmael's standpoint. Because oftentimes when we read this story, we act like Ishmael didn't know what was going on. But if you read the text, he was 13 years old before he was circumcised. Before he got kicked out the second time, he was 14 years old. I digress from that. God is pursuing you. God hears you. God sees you. When you are wondering how God comforts the lonely, God pursues, he hears, he sees. Pastor, how do you know this? How do you know this is what the text is saying? And how can I believe that this is what God is doing? And can I simply just say this? The Bible tells me so. The scriptures tell me so. Let me show you where. God pursues the lonely. The first words we read about Hagar and her loneliness, about Hagar and her isolation in Genesis chapter 16, verse 7 is this: the angel of the Lord found her. The angel of the Lord found her. The first words that you see, you don't hear the conditions of the weather. You don't hear what she is going through. The first words you hear is the angel of the Lord found her. Four times in this pericope alone, the angel of the Lord found her. He's pursuing her. He didn't wait for her to turn towards him. He turned towards her. The word angel of the Lord, just a quick theology note, is a theophany. A theophany is a visible revelation of the invisible God. It's what New Testament scholars will refer to as the second person of the Trinity, which we know as Jesus. Can I tell you something about Hagar? This was the first woman who saw the physical representation of God. Hagar, bruh, an Egyptian. She's not even Jewish. She saw God. See, oftentimes when people talk about that the Bible isn't pro-woman, I'm like, man, you just got to read the text, man. You got to read the text. And the text says the angel of the Lord found her. He pursued her. In fact, the word well, isn't it ironic that every time God does something great, it's by a well? Every time he does something great, it's by a well, a spring of life. He met her at the well. Here's the second thing. The angel of the Lord addressed her as Hagar before a slave. This is personal to him. He knows her name. He knows who who she is. Look at verse 8. I got to read it. I wanted to read from the text. Look at verse 8. It says, and he said, Hagar, slave of Sarai, where have you come from and where are you going? She replied, I'm running away from my mistress, Sarai. He called her by her name. No one else has called her by her name up until now. But God says, I know you. I know what your name is. In fact, God asks her questions. Now, have we learned anything? That God never asks questions that he don't know the answer to? God never asks questions that he's baffled by? Oftentimes when God asks us questions, it's for two reasons: confession or revelation, right? Either he's trying to get you to confess, Adam, where are you? Or revelation, I need you to know who I am. Right? And so the angel of the Lord calls her by her name because this is personal to him. He has saw what Sarai and Abram have done to her, and he has pursued her. Here's the last one. The angel of the Lord tells her to go back to where she came from. I'm going to explain this. But listen to what he says. The angel of the Lord said to her, go back to your mistress and submit to her authority. The angel of the Lord said to her, I will greatly multiply your offsprings and they will be too many to count. All right. Why is God telling her to go back to her abusers? All right. I would never tell someone who's being abused to go back. I would never be in a position so boldly that I think that I can tell somebody to go back to their abuser. So why is God doing it? First of all, he's God. See, when you read stuff like this, the first thing that you have to do is go back to God's character. And we know that God's character is good. that everything he does is good. He makes the right decision the right way all the time. So when you read this text, go back to the character of God, because whatever God is doing, he's up to something that is good. Not only good for him, but it's good for you. Why is he telling her to go back? Because he knows in order for her to receive the blessing that he just bestowed upon her, she has to be under the covering of the patriarch. This is the first time that the covenant of Moses or of Abraham is fulfilled. Watch this, Craig. Remember he says, I'm going to bless you, and through you all nations will be blessed. What nation is she from? She a Gentile. She's not a Jew. Hagar is the first to experience the covenantal blessing of God because her connection with Abram. He says, I want you to go back so that you might get all the benefits and all the rights and all the privileges of a covenant person. That's why he says to her in the second verse, chapter 10, and your seed will be multiplied. Well, where did we hear that? That's what he said to Abram. He's telling her to go back for two reasons, so that she might be under the covenant blessing of Abraham, and watch this, so that she might trust God. It is what Abraham and Sarah did not do. Because the blessing doesn't come for another 14 years, but she was willing to trust God and wait on it, whereas Abraham and Sarah have constantly found ways to manipulate the plan of God. Remember, when God tells you to do something that is out of bounds, hear me when I say that, it is good. He has a plan. He has a purpose. Some of the things that you are resistant towards God, some of the things that you are fighting against God, would you just surrender? Would you allow God to speak to you and to hear his voice and obey? That'll come back up in a second. Secondly, God hears the lonely. In Genesis chapter 16, verses 11 through 12, it says, the angel of the Lord said to her, you have conceived and will have a son. You will name him Ishmael, for the Lord has heard your cry of affliction. This man will be like a wild donkey. His hands will be against everyone, and everyone's hand will be against him. He will settle near all of his relatives. There's a lot of beautiful things here, right? The first thing he says to her is that you will have a son, and his name will be Ishmael. Do you know what the name Ishmael means? God who hears. God who listens. The reason why God names him Ishmael is because every time Hagar and every time his descendants refer to him, they're going to hear, God listens. God hears. God listens. God hears. See, the reason why it is important sometimes to make sure that you're naming your child according to what you are trying to set them up, so that every time they hear their name, they know that God is present. She should be overwhelmed to name this child this, because every time she says it, she's reminded that God heard my cry, that God heard my plea, that God listens to me. In other words, she get a chance to experience God's mercy and his grace every time she says Ishmael's name. Now, oftentimes when we see that he refers to him as a wild donkey, our first response is that this is negative, right? Now, for all you animal lovers out there, tell me, is a wild donkey vicious? I mean, I know it bites and I know it's stubborn, but is it on like the predatorial high? Like, man, you better not get close to that donkey, man. That thing will kill you, right? Look at all the farmers. That's not what the text is saying. Here's what a wild donkey is known for in Israel: freedom. He said, your descendants, along with you, will never be a slave again. And I know you look at the state of Palestine and Israel and you're trying to make sense of all this, but hear me when I say this. He's letting them know that you will be free. How do I know this? Well, remember the second time she gets pushed out? Not because of what she did, but because once again, Sarah says, I don't want that son, Ishmael, to have the blessings of Isaac, not realizing that God has already given them a blessing several times. Well, the next time she gets pushed out, you know what he calls her? Hagar. He does not have the adjective slave because she's free. See, when you listen to God, you are free. When you listen to God, there's freedom attached to that. When you listen to God, there's no longer a bondage in that. See, the reason why some of us are still stuck in our isolated position and our state of loneliness is because we're not willing to listen to the God who hears us. And if you could just listen to your brother and your sibling who's been in bondage so many different times as it relates to parental pain, if you would just listen to God, there would be freedom. Let me give you a piece of me. I hated male authority. I couldn't stand a man telling me what to do. It was painful. And I used to always use this phrase, you're not my daddy. And I know this person ain't my dad. He don't look like me. He don't act. I used to say that all the time. You're not my daddy. Don't talk to me. And I remember reading the passages in the Bible in college. And it says, I am the fatherless. I'm the father to the fatherless. And something in me broke. I said, God is my father. He has been there the whole time. He has intervened the whole time in my life, and something to me snapped. Why? Because for the first time, I listened. I listened. There is freedom in listening to God. Here's the last one. God sees the lonely. In Genesis chapter 16, verse 13, it says, so she named the Lord who spoke to her, you are El Roy. For she said, in this place, I have actually seen the one who sees me. In this place, I have actually seen the one who's seen me. The angel of the Lord, the theophany, what we know as Jesus, she says, I see you. Another trivial fact, but you need to hear this. Hagar is the first person, first woman to ever name God. Like, she get the privilege of doing, dude, he is working so much stuff out in this story so that you might understand that in your loneliness, he pursues you. He don't care your ethnicity. He don't care how broken you are. He don't care how much money you have. He don't care where you are from. He said, I see you. You're not too far from me to reach. You're not too broken for me to put back together. You're not too angry for me to show mercy. He said, I see you. And when Hagar heard this, notice what her response is. Elroy. Elroy. He is the God who sees me. When he tells her to go back, she's like, Elroy told me to go back. When he tells her to go back into an abusive situation, I know Elroy is going to take care of me. She knows that God is the one who sees. And so for those who are lonely, for those who feel isolated, there's three things you need to know about God. That he will pursue you. That he will listen to you. and he does see you. So what is your response? Well, do what Hagar did. Hagar did two things. She listened to the voice of God, and she obeyed it. Would you do two things for those who are in this situation? Will you read the Word of God? Because the Bible teaches us that the Word of God is breathed out. It is the voice of God. For those who are experiencing this loneliness, would you do something? Would you read the voice of God? And then when you read the voice of God, would you listen to it and obey it? Now, I hear some of us are saying, Pastor, I've already done that, and it doesn't work. I've read cover to cover, and every time I read, I still feel the same way. Not knowing your situation, can I say something to you? And this is coming from someone who navigated these same terrains. Oftentimes when I read the scripture, I was looking for myself. I was looking for myself in the scripture. I was looking for what God can do for me. But somewhere along the line, I stopped reading the Bible looking for myself, and I started reading the Bible looking for God. I wanted to know what he thought. I wanted to know what motivated him. I wanted to know how he loved. I wanted to know what made him angry. All of a sudden, reading the Bible with the lenses of looking for God, then I began to experience the character of God, the righteousness of God, the love of God, the hope of God. What I'm asking you, read it again. Read it again. But don't start with your circumstance. Start with the God who created the world. Don't start with you as the winner and the hero in the story. Start with him and what he has done. Read it one more time. And when you read it, look for who God is. Look for what God has done. See what motivates him. And my prayer is that when you begin to look to see what God has done and what God and who God is, things will begin to break. Because all of a sudden I begin to realize what changed. The moment I begin to look for God, the moment I begin to understand my identity, I begin to know who I was. I begin to know, even when I'm broken, how he brings me out. In fact, I want to read a couple of scriptures over you as the band comes to the stage. For those who don't feel like God cares, listen to his voice. In 1 Peter 5:6, he says, humble yourself, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, so that he may exalt you at the proper time, casting all your cares on him. Why? Because he cares. For those who are struggling, trying to figure out if God cares, he says, I care, humble yourself. To those who are looking for rest, this is what he says. Come to me, all those who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you. Learn from me, because I am lowly and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your soul. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. Who needs some rest? To the one who is struggling with sin, listen to what John said. He says, if you confess your sin, he is faithful and righteous to forgive us of our sins and to cleanse us of all unrighteousness. Somebody needs to be free there. Here's the last one for those who are struggling with injustice. Therefore, the Lord is waiting to show mercy, and he is rising up to show you compassion. For the Lord is a just God, and all who wait patiently for him will be happy. Would you listen to the voice of God? And would you obey?
Thank you again for listening to the Disciple City Church podcast. Until we meet again, Shalom.